Good morning, we'll get started. I'm glad to welcome you here for our Lou Jones breakfast. We're going to start in a minute with new bankruptcy rules and CMECF and this new DEBN program that we have. But before we get started, I want to introduce Judge Cannon. She's going to come on over. She's just started. You can see her in Oshkosh, et cetera. She started officially Friday, but started getting cases yesterday, and I asked her how many pro se's, and she said none, and I turned to Sean and said, what's going on with that? But we're just so excited to have her. And as I sent out on the listserv, she's going to temporarily have her chambers only upstairs. And then Judge Pepper is actually moving upstairs to her new space June 15th. So then Judge Hannon is going to move into Judge Pepper's old space. And her courtroom will be Judge Pepper's old courtroom. Eventually, we think she's going to move to Judge McGarrity's courtroom, but those two are right next door to each other, so hopefully that won't be too confusing for everybody. But
on probation.
Yeah. We're pleased to welcome her, and be nice to her, please. I'm just so excited to have her join us.
Glad to be here.
Right. Also for those here in Milwaukee, I have a new law clerk who started yesterday, Carrie Tice. So don't call Nicole anymore, call Carrie. We're going to get started. I'm going to take my... First, I want to tell you what we've got coming up. Today, of course, we're having our CMECF and bankruptcy rules. July 14th, we're back to the second Tuesday. That's our normal day, July 14th. Our speakers are Ryan Blay and Nathan Zimmerman, and they're going to talk about the happiness package, divorce, and Chapter 13 bankruptcy. So come back for that. August, our trustees, Rebecca Garcia and Mary Grossman, are going to talk about Chapter 13 hot topics. August 11th, second Tuesday. So come on back for that. We don't have anything yet for September and October. We're working on it. If you have ideas, we welcome those, of course. November and December, we have our annual thing set up, the Supreme Court review. Okay, the Supreme Court has something like 6 bankruptcy decisions that it's issued this term. So come on back in November for our Supreme Court review and preview of what's coming. And then our ethics in December with Paula's cookies. So that's what we've got coming up. Please come back and please suggest topics. And if you'd like to be a speaker, we would welcome your participation. So now I'm going to be a presenter. Okay. We are going to talk about, this is Sean McDermott, Chief Deputy Clerk in the Eastern District. This is Michelle Hawley. If you've had training in CMECF, you've met Michelle. And we're going to talk about the new bankruptcy rules that just became effective December 1st, 2014, and also some other new, Michelle's going to give us a refresher on opening adversary proceedings. She was telling me that a lot of debtors attorneys especially are relying on their software to help them open the main bankruptcy case. But when it comes to opening an adversary proceeding to strip a lien or go against, get a preference back from a, you know, garnishment or something, now you've got to do it all manually. So Michelle's going to walk us through and give us some, just a little refresher on how to do that. And then Sean is going to talk about this debtor electronic noticing. And also, I really hope that you came with some questions that are, might come up for you, or some issues that you're having with CM or, you know, electronic filing in general. Because these guys are the experts, and we'll help you work through that. But I'm going to start us off with the new bankruptcy rules that came in to effect December 1st, as I said. And there's about 5 new rules that are really nothing special, but there's a lot of new rules in the 8000 series, and those are the appeal rules. And I'm not encouraging appeals, but... if you find yourself wanting to, you need to know that these things have changed, and they've changed significantly. I'm interested in the topic, and I thought that in, to cover it for the Ginsburg and Martin treatise, shameless plug, I thought that there would be like a red line version so I could just see where the rules changed. Oh no, there is no red line version. They rewrote them. So the rules are completely different. They're not all changed, but they're completely rewritten. And it's important that you, when you go to look up the rules, that you have the latest version. I know there was an appeal filed of one of my orders rather, you know, say January, February, early on, and the attorney, who's an experienced bankruptcy attorney, was obviously not aware of the changes, and he was using his old rule book and trying to follow the old rules. You don't want that to happen to you. You don't want to do write letters to the district court and say the other guy's brief is overdue when it really wasn't overdue. The attorney was not using the most current version of the rules. So, you know, our, the new mini codes have them now. They're, you can link from our website if you, you know, aren't somebody who buys new rule books every year. You can get them online. But be careful. Don't just rely on your old standard that's from pre-2014, December 2014, because you will not have the current version of the rules. I have an outline that's posted online, and I've gone through and I've said stuff that has changed and hasn't changed. What hasn't changed, I think the most important not change, is the 14-day appeal period. And we know that this 14-day appeal period is really short. It's shorter than other court systems. If you want to appeal a bankruptcy court order, you only have 14 days. That is, you know, not a whole lot of time when you're trying to decide what to do. Now, you can get that 14-day period extended, but so you have more time to think about it and talk it over with your client and see what's going on. But there's certain kind of orders that you cannot get an extension. Maybe the most common one that you might want to appeal, but you can't get an extension of the 14-day appeal period, is an order granting relief from stay. So if there's been an order granting relief from the stay, you got 14 days to take that appeal. You cannot ask for more time. Other types of orders, you know, that you might run across, you could get more time. The best way to get more time is to ask in the 14 days. Ask for the extension before the 14 days expires. But even if the 14 days is gone and you can show excusable neglect, you can get the appeal period extended even if the 14 days is gone for a limited period of time, and you have to show excusable neglect. If we get time at the very end of the program, and if we don't, it's in the outline that's posted online, I want to talk to you about a recent case about excusable neglect, so you know what's up with that. So the 14-day appeal period has not changed. Certain motions, if the judge has issued a decision and order, and you file, certain motions will extend the 14-day appeal period. Like a motion, people call it a motion to reconsider. That's really not the legal technical term for it, but we all know that's what it is. So a motion for additional findings of fact and conclusions of law or something like that, or a motion to vacate the order because a mistake has been made. Basically, a motion to reconsider will extend the appeal period as long as they are filed within the 14-day appeal period. So once the 14 days goes, now you file a motion, and you can file a motion to reconsider or vacate after that appeal period is expired, but it won't extend the appeal period if it gets denied. Okay? So that's the timing of that. The notice of appeal is filed in the bankruptcy court. Even though you know you're appealing to the district court, you don't file the appeal up there. You file it with us in the bankruptcy court. There is an official form you want to follow. And if you're the other side and you don't like part of the ruling,
you can, even though you won, you don't like everything the judge did, you can file what's called a cross appeal. And that's filed within 14 days of the other side's appeal. So I recently had a case where I entered an order and the first side appealed. The other side didn't like some of the relief they had requested, had not gotten granted. Now they appealed. That's called a cross appeal. And throughout the rules, they are very specific of what you do if you have filed a cross appeal. We're not going to talk about them a lot today. They're not that common, but know that they're there and that you should look that up if you're considering it. Now, this is a change, and it really affects the clerk's office, but also the lawyers to a certain extent. We used to wait when an appeal got filed. We waited for the statement of the issues and the designation of the record before we would ship it up to the district court. And you would get your judge assigned, and you would get a letter from the district court saying, we've got your appeal, it's going to be Judge Adelman, and here's your briefing letter, and now all your deadlines are going to run. That was the old way. The new way, the day the notice of appeal is filed, as soon as the notice of appeal is filed, it is shipped to the district court. And I'm saying shipped like it's we're physically walking it up there. No, it's an electronic thing that you're opening up the appeal in the district court. Correct, Sean?
Right. We have the bankruptcy court has electronic filing privileges in district court. So as soon as that notice of appeal is filed, we will log into district court, upload the notice along with what the district court considers a short record, which is the order from which the appeal lies, any associated memorandums of law, and a copy of the docket sheet. So all that information goes up immediately.
And they assign the judge
right away.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to start filing stuff up there, but if you do have a motion that needs to be considered right away, you would still file it in the bankruptcy court. We will ship it up. We now know exactly which judge has it. It's got a case number. So the idea is they can consider all this stuff more efficiently than they could before. So they, even though it's gone up there, you now you can tell who your judge is on appeal. You will still be filing your designation of the record and your statement of issues in the bankruptcy court. And we collect the items from the record, and when they're all done, and we have the appellant file first, then the appellee files, and those all are transmitted by Sean and the clerks in the bankruptcy court to the district court. That it's changed only in that we already know where they're going, rather than the old way, which was we waited for everything and then shipped it, and then you got your judge. Now you know what your case number is up there, and all that stuff will go. Another change, transcripts. And we have a new event, and Sean will tell you about it. If you, it used to be kind of loosey-goosey about what you do about a transcript. Now you're basically required to say, I'm either getting one or I'm not. You're getting one, great, there's the procedure, you go on the website and you contact the reporter and they have certain deadlines, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're not getting a transcript, you have to fill out an event in the docket that says, I'm not getting a transcript. Just a slight, you know, and you're like, why would I get a transcript? That's expensive. Maybe a little warning. If you're going to argue on appeal that there was something wrong with the evidence, the way the judge let in evidence or a certain fact that the bankruptcy judge found, you have to have a transcript to be able to point the district judge to the place where you're saying the mistake was. So if you don't want to get a transcript because they're expensive or you don't think you need one, you have to think about, what am I arguing on appeal? If it's purely a question of law, maybe you don't need one. But if you're arguing, the judge didn't let my witness testify because she said it was hearsay, or she said something, he wasn't an expert. You're going to want that transcript so that the district judge can see what was argued and what was in that evidence. Okay? That makes sense. Now, there is this thing that I don't even like to talk about because I don't want to encourage it. There's the statement of the record, which, you know, if you're familiar with appeals, you know that you have to tell the clerk, list docket entries that you want. So if you're appealing, if you're a creditor and you objected to confirmation of a plan, and now the judge overruled your objection and confirmed the plan, and you're going to appeal that, okay? Of course you want to designate the plan. You want to designate your objection. You want to designate any memorandum of law. Maybe there were amended plans along the way. You probably want to designate those. So you're making up your the items for your record that you want the district court to see, right? Now, this Rule 8009 says, if the parties agree, they can tell the bankruptcy judge, this is what we think the appeal is about. You basically figure out what the record should be and send it to the district court. We don't want to encourage this. We think you should pick your record, and apparently this rule is taken from the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, and nobody ever does this there either. So don't do it, but I'm telling you that it's there. This is a change, may be of interest, and we're going to talk about this in a second. Sealed documents. Sealed documents can be part of an appeal. But you don't just say, I had this document under seal in the bankruptcy court. I'm going to designate it, and now it goes to the district court under the same seal. You have to ask the district court to accept the document under seal, and then the district court decides. Apparently, these rules are basically modeled after the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure. They're supposed to be brought in line with those rules. In other words, the rules that you use if you're appealing a district court judgment or order up to the Court of Appeals. These rules have now been modified to match those. So, in the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, if you want the Court of Appeals to think of a document or to keep a document under seal, you have to ask them, and they'll decide. In the Archdiocese bankruptcy, of course, we have a lot of documents under seal, and it's not like they've said, oh, no, we don't agree with everybody who thinks these should stay under seal. But it's just another step you need to think about. So if you're designating documents that you want under seal, you have to file a motion in the district court and ask them to keep it under seal. Now we are, the record's complete. We've got our statement of the issues. We've got our statement of the record. We've got any motions to keep documents under seal all taken care of. Now the record's all complete. Transcripts have arrived, or we have the statement that we're not getting a transcript. Now you're sending those documents, again, right, filing all those documents in that file in the district court, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
So we'll compile a single document that is the lead document is a docket sheet. It's all bookmarked. Some of you may have seen it. We send that in one file to district court. We just log into the case. We attach it to the case that we previously opened, and that's about it. So it's a real quick process. As soon as those two 14-day deadlines expire, we are transmitting that document the next day.
Right. Now another change. Now, when the district court gets those documents, they're going to send out what they call the briefing letter. And they're going to send that out to the lawyers and say, we've got the record. Now all your deadlines are going to start to run. Okay? The briefs used to be due like 14 days later. Now it's 30 days. That's the good news. The first brief, the appellant's brief, is due 30 days after docketing of the notice that the record has been transmitted or is available electronically. If the appellant fails to file the brief on time or within any, you can ask for an extension. The appellee may move to dismiss the appeal, or the district court, after notice, may dismiss the appeal on its own motion. So if you're a party to appeal, an appeal, Sean, if we get sometimes pro ses who appeal and people that appeal that are just mad and they want to appeal. So they file this notice of appeal. Number one, there is a fee, but we don't say you can't appeal without it. That's basically up to the district court to do something if they haven't paid the appeal fee. But so they file what they call an appeal, and I'm talking about a pro se usually. Mm-hmm. You wait the number of days and just say, we don't have anything. We don't have any designations. We don't have any statement of issues. And you just let the district court know that.
Right.
Now it's up to the district court, or if you were on the other side of this issue, you could file motion to dismiss the appeal. They haven't complied with the rules. They haven't filed a brief. They haven't done anything. They're just mad at the bankruptcy judge, basically. Or the district court, and we've seen this happen, they go, what is this? It's been sitting here for 6 months. We're dismissing this appeal that this pro se has filed. Also changed, the timing is better, so you get more time to do your brief, but now the format is basically governed by these rules. You have to have your corporate disclosure statement. You have to have a table of contents in your brief. You have to have a table of authorities. This sounds like law school, writing those briefs in law school. Yeah, here we are. All of this is in the rules now. A statement of the issues, a statement of jurisdiction. If you've ever appealed something all the way up to the Court of Appeals, God love you, and you have to be very aware of the jurisdiction. And does the court have jurisdiction over the appeal? The appeals basically break down into two categories. Appeals from a final order and appeals from an interlocutory order. If you're not appealing from a final order, you need to get permission from the district court in the first instance to appeal an interlocutory order. There's all kinds of different categories, the way they put it, whether an appeal is final or whether an order is final or interlocutory for appeal purposes. The Supreme Court, one of our cases that came down this term, said that an order denying confirmation of a plan, a Chapter 13 plan, is not a final order. That's an interlocutory order, and in order to appeal that, you have to ask permission. You have to ask permission of the court to take that appeal. It's bad for debtors. It's good for creditors, I guess, and trustees. But if you have a legal issue, and I have one right now with my friend Len Leverson, where his Chapter 13 plan had, I call it a balloon, he has a more less of a name for it, not balloon, but I thought it violated the equal payment provision of Chapter 13. You're aware of that for the secured claims. You got to have equal monthly. If you're going to have monthly payments, they got to be equal monthly payments. No balloons, no step plans, whatever you guys want to call it. If the creditor consents, okay. But if the creditor says, no, I want equal monthly payments, you're not supposed to have these. Well, Len had some creative idea of how to make equal monthly, how to meet the equal monthly payments, but not have to actually pay equal monthly payments. This is my spin, because I said no. That plan is not confirmable. Denied. Len appealed, but he, to be careful, because the Supreme Court case had not come down, filed a motion for leave to appeal. In case the Supreme Court said denial of confirmation is not a final order, he's got to make sure that the district court agrees to hear his appeal. And this is a legal issue that courts differ on, so it's likely, and I think the court is considering it in the district court. So you see what I'm saying. If Len had not done that, if Len had just said, it's a final order, I'm appealing it, and the district court disagreed with him, now he gets up to the Seventh Circuit and says, here I am. He's got a problem, because that's not a final order. And the Seventh Circuit doesn't have jurisdiction of appeals except for final orders. So I'm just making that distinction and warning you to be careful about telling the court that it has proper appellate jurisdiction of the final order. You also need, again, the brief requirements have changed. You need to read them if you're going to file an appeal brief in the district court. There's a page limit. There's a font suggestion. You have to have an appendix to your brief that attaches certain things. There's lots of stuff like that. The district court must accept briefs that comply with 8015. That's the rule that has all these requirements. By local rule, a district court may accept documents that do not meet the requirements. Another change, oral argument. It used to be you would never have oral argument in the district court. It's not, it was presumed it would be on the brief. So make sure your brief is really good, because you're not going to be able to stand up there and explain it if the district judge didn't get it. But now it says it's presumed that there will be oral argument. This is Rule 8019. It's presumed there will be oral argument unless the district court decides I don't need it. It's a frivolous appeal, or the briefs are super clear, or whatever. So I think you might be seeing more oral argument. I'm going to wrap up here quickly. I just want to point out the rest of the outline talks about motions. If you want a motion for stay pending appeal, first you have to ask the bankruptcy court to stay it. If the bankruptcy court says, no, I'm not going to stay the order pending the appeal, then you ask the district court to please stay it. There's different motions, and depending on whether the record has been transmitted or not, you file those motions in the bankruptcy court or the district court. All of this is pointed out in the outline. So there is also one thing I just wanted to mention that's new. An appellate court may have a mediation procedure for bankruptcy appeals. So you might find yourself party to an appeal, and all of a sudden the district court says, hey, have you guys thought about mediation? I've got this nice magistrate judge here who could maybe help settle your appeal for you. You wouldn't have expected that in the past, but now that's something that's built into the rules. So I hope you never have to use these rules in my cases. But if you do, please, please, please make sure you're using a current version of the rules. You're checking out that transcript thing. You're making sure you have jurisdiction in the court. And you're, calling Sean if you have any questions. Michelle.
Good morning, everyone. So I'm going to talk about the motion for redaction. And this is another rule as of December 1st, 2014. And the main change here is that in order to file a motion to redact personal identifying information, which is the Social Security number, dates of birth, names of minor children, and financial account numbers, in compliance with the Federal Rules of Bankruptcy Procedure 9037, you have to now file a motion, and it's called a motion to redact. If some of you might be familiar, this used to be called motion to restrict public access, and we have retired that event and replaced it with this event. And now there's a $25 fee that's associated with this. So some of you might have been a little bit surprised or shocked when you received a defective filing notification telling you that, oh, by the way, you filed something that contained one of these personal identifiers, and now you have to file a motion with the court, ask for that document to be restricted, and you have to pay a fee to have that done. And just a little bit of a differentiation here, 9037 specifically has to do with those four identifiers: Social Security number, dates of birth, names of minor children, financial account numbers. So how it differentiates between, you know, Judge Motion or mentioned about sealing records. If you're needing records to be not seen by the public, so you need them to be restricted from public viewing, let's say medical documentation, trade secrets, something real personal, you want to file the sealed records procedure. And that's actually outlined in our administrative procedures, but essentially what you're going to do is you're going to file a motion to seal. That's going to be your motion. Please don't contain the documents in which you want to seal in that particular event, because that's the event that appears on the public docket. And then immediately thereafter, you're going to use this event called sealed documents. And sealed documents is the documents, you know, you're essentially showing the court or you're showing the judge, hey, these are the records that I'm referring to. It gives an opportunity for the judge to review those documents without them being available on the public docket and make a decision as to whether or not they should be out there or not. If the judge denies it, you know, it gives you an opportunity to withdraw the documents if you decide, hey, maybe I really don't want those to be visible to the public. So it hides them until the court either, and when the court approves it, then the clerk's office is going to go in the background and essentially open it up to everybody to be able to see. So please, there's no fee to do that. There's no fee to ask for records to be sealed, but there is a difference. So when you're accidentally including Form 21, which is a statement of Social Security with the full Social Security number, when you file your initial petition, that's a no-go. We're going to end up restricting that whole document. You will get a defective filing notification, and that defective filing notification says the court has restricted the document and you have to file a motion and pay the fee. So some of you might ask, well, if the court's already taken the action of restricting the document, why do I need to go forward? Well, because the rule says that you do. And we've gotten the question, and essentially because of the rule change on December 1st, and because essentially we had a lot of creditor filers who were filing information that shouldn't have been out there, so you know it kind of came down saying, okay, the court's spending a lot of time going back and restricting these documents. So
yeah, Jay. No. he's hiding under the desk. He's shrinking down. No.
So when you get this, make sure that you are still filing the motion, even though the court has restricted the access, because the defective filing notification indicates that if you don't follow the procedure, that the judge could actually strike your document from the record.
Right.
So you don't want that to happen.
Right. And I mean, it's really important. If it's a proof of claim, you don't want that stricken from the record. So just pay the $25. It'll be okay. But I also want to point out, I think, a pretty cool feature of the sealed feature, not this redacted stuff for your Social Security number or account number, but for the sealed feature, the court can decide only certain people can see that. Clearly, the court personnel can see it. But if you want your trustee to be able to see the sealed document, or if you want the creditor in a Chapter 11, you want the creditors committee to be able to see it, but nobody else. We can tailor who can see the sealed document. So keep that in mind. Now, I think the main place a consumer lawyer is going to use the seal is the debtor is not qualified to understand to take either the pre-petition credit briefing or the post-petition financial management course. The debtor is either incapacitated mentally or if they're dead, I don't see how that's that personal, but if you want to tell us why, what happened, that's fine. I would say, Judge, I've got information that I want to share to tell you why this debtor shouldn't have to take the financial management course. I would prefer that you file a motion to seal that so that it's not, I don't think it's anybody's business, you know, what the mental capacity is. Now, again, if the trustee's going, hey, wait a minute, if I look fine at the 341, you know, maybe we'll say, hey, let the trustee see it too. But, I mean, that kind of thing I think can be done basically ex parte. You ask the judge, please seal the document, the medical record that shows my client cannot attend the 341. okay? Or my client cannot take the financial management course. They are incapacitated, they're in a nursing home, they have Alzheimer's. Any of that kind of personal stuff, you know, it's asked to seal that. A lot of times we get it from pro se debtors love to tell us their medical histories. And we restrict that, you know, just by ourselves. But if you're a lawyer representing somebody with these kind of issues, please ask and use this feature to get the document sealed.
And if you're not sure on the language, we actually have sample motion to redact and a sample order on our local forms page on our website. So just take a look there and obviously tailor it to your specific situation. One note on the motion to redact, and not to pick on the creditor attorneys, but I find that it's not the motion, it's not the documents that you're actually drafting that contain the personal identifying information, it's the supporting docs. So you gotta make sure that you, your support staff, before you're scanning that stuff in and sending it over, that you're going in with a Sharpie and just redacting everything but those last four digits, especially financial account numbers. I think that's the one that we probably see the most.
Right, right. They can be buried on, you know, page 12 of a mortgage or whatever, so.
Well, in the clerk's office, we do our best to, when we're doing quality assurance, we do quality assurance on every single document that comes through. That being said, we do quality assurance on every single document that comes through, and there are thousands of documents. And so we're, you know, scanning through, and we do, you know, like I said, we do our best to try to catch that stuff, but the onus is really on the filer. So, you know, we try to help out as much as we can because we don't want that person's personal identifying information out on the public docket either.
Right, and you know, when you're filing, you are checking a box that says, I'm certifying by filing this, I have gone through and I understand the privacy rules and I have redacted. So don't just mindlessly check that box. Think about it and think about getting rid of that Social Security number. I mean, the kids' names and stuff, whatever. But, I mean, it's important, and we will, if we catch it, we will ask you to pay the $25. And as far as, well, why should I, if you did catch it, why should I pay? The case that I had called Ortiz versus Aurora was just about this. It was about a creditor that filed stuff that the debtor's attorney said shouldn't have been filed, and they sued. You don't want to be sued because you didn't be careful with what you were filing. So that's another incentive. Doug?
When you get an order to redact, are they redacting the documents that are already on file? If you know what I mean, is the clerk's office going through and blacking out the inappropriate areas, or are you restricting total access?
We're restricting total access, so then you need to come back and file that document again, redacted.
Okay.
With the information redacted.
Right.
Okay.
Like Judge mentioned, you are checking a box that indicates that you understand that you have to comply with the rule. On the debtor side, if you're using best case or easy filing, that's already defaulted, so I know that you're probably just checking it, but please note that you are agreeing to the terms so that, you know, as the judge indicated, we're going to hold you to that. So I just did a step-by-step. Some of the copies are not real great because I think my printer got a little hot. So these are going to be posted out on the court website on the Lou Jones page and in addition on the training page. But essentially, you're going to go through, like, you're filing a motion, putting in the case number. In this particular circumstance, we're going to construe this or consider this to be like an ex parte motion. So you're not going to need to send notice. You're not going to need to draft a certificate of service. Just a motion to the court asking for the document to be redacted. The event, like I indicated in the pick list, is called redact. You'll indicate whether you're filing with another party or joint filing with another attorney. And then the one thing here, if you are a creditor who only filed a proof of claim, okay, in this particular circumstance, your party is not going to be a party in the party pick list for the docket side of the house. Remember, the docket and the claims register are essentially two separate animals. So you will have to go through, add or create a new party and add your new party to the case, which will then, of course, add you to the NEF recipient list for the rest of your life, unless you go in and terminate your existence in that case. When you're adding parties to the case, just a note, please don't put phone numbers, email addresses, anything like that in the party fields. When that party record, when someone goes out and searches, let's say, Bay Lake Bank, and somebody has put that information in an old party record, if someone pulls that accidentally, that's going to be associated, that email address could potentially be associated with a case that has nothing to do with, in the future, that particular email address. So we don't want to put erroneous email addresses in permanent party records. With regard to attaching your motion, just a note here that, you know, we've talked about, if you have the opportunity from your word processing software to convert documents directly to PDF as opposed to printing them, signing them, and scanning them back in, that's going to be the preferred method. Sometimes when they get scanned in, they're sideways, they're askew, they look a little, you know, maybe not as legible, that if you can just use your software. If you recall from the local rules and the admin procedures, your login and password constitutes your signature. So you don't need to physically print the documents, sign them, and scan them back in. You don't even need to put the /. Your login and password and your filing of the document constitutes your signature.
Some courts have actual rules that you must create the PDF with the software and not scan it. And I have seen, you know, deficiency notices being given to people. Now, we're not there, but I get some, and it's orders that people are asking me to sign, and they're crooked like this. And I'm like, okay, yes, all right. It's not something that I take pride in considering an order of a federal court when it looks like crap. Sorry. So we're not there. We want to work with you, and we understand that not everybody has these features in their software. But if you do, please use them rather than the scanning, because it's almost 100% of the time creates a better looking, better, more readable document when you do it that way.
When the event...
Alex.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to make a comment that I also prefer the non-scanned image. However, I've got clients who are concerned about metadata that's embedded in a document, or if you're electronically redacting certain parts of a document, that not printing and scanning can lead to unintended disclosure of that metadata, or redacted personal information that then can be exposed. And so, you know, that is a concern with not scanning.
It is my understanding that you can resave that PDF image without that metadata. So I guess that would be, you know, if you're doing that conversion and that metadata exists, resave it, and there is a feature in Adobe to resave without, like, basically to scrub it. So I would recommend doing that if that's the situation,
right,
before you attach it.
And clearly, as far as exhibits to your document, of course you're going to scan those, but I'm talking about the documents that you're actually typing up, motions, you know, briefs, orders. Those are certainly easier and better for the court, for the parties, if you use the scan or the PDF create or not.
And most of the time, it's not the documents that you're actually drafting. It's probably the supporting docs that you're attaching.
Those can be scanned, obviously. You don't have to re-enter those. That'd be awful.
With regard to referring back, so please make sure you're linking your motion to redact back to the document on the entry that on the docket that you actually want to redact. There's a hint here with regard to proof of claims. So this functionality doesn't allow you to link to the claims register. So in your final docket text, when you get that open text box, you're just going to want to, you know, indicate in that text box, because in this functionality, there is no way to link back to the claims register. So which entry should be restricted? Link back to that one. And like I said, there is a $25 fee. So the rest of it just looks like a regular motion. And then after the motion is docketed, you'll get prompted to pay. Obviously, you want to make sure that you do that timely. And then uploading the order is just like we would normally do. So order upload, single order upload under ex parte, and then link it back to the motion to redact.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it's not It's not too hard, but we have gotten a lot of calls because unfortunately, maybe not everybody was aware of the rules. So initially when we started issuing the defective filing notifications and asking for a fee, we got quite a few questions on that. And again, about, well, if you already restricted it, then why do I have to go forward and do the rest of the process? Does anybody have any additional questions about the motion to redact versus the motion to seal or anything like that? All right, and then I'm briefly just gonna talk about the adversary case opening. So I know that in the grand scheme, not a lot of attorneys have the opportunity or need to file adversary proceedings. So when I initially work with you, if you've ever come in and seen me or if I've ever trained with you, I'll usually, especially talk about, depending on what side you are, how to open bankruptcies, petitions, the main case, or file a motion for relief from stay in that motions procedure. But rarely, unless someone specifically calls and asks, do I get an opportunity in the 2-hour block that I have to really talk about adversaries. And so I usually say, if you ever need to file an adversary, give me a call. I will walk you through it the first time. And the help desk really loves that. So a lot of people call the help desk, and someone from the help desk walks you through. So I've created this handy-dandy cheat sheet to hopefully help with that process. So unlike if you have a bankruptcy preparation software, that's creating the bankruptcy petition or opening the main case for you. But like Judge Kelly mentioned before, in an adversary, you have to do this manually. So under the adversary menu, you go to open an AP case. You indicate that you want to file a complaint because essentially the complaint is the minimum filing requirement. So please make sure that you at least have that. Putting in the lead bankruptcy case number, so what case is this associated with. Doing the same search that you would do when you're entering a party in a main case. Okay, so you're using that search function. I will let you know if the plaintiff or defendant, I mean, one of the parties is typically going to be the debtor. The best way to search by them, if you know, is by their Social Security number. As you know, sometimes debtors have multiple cases, so sometimes searching by Jane Smith isn't going to yield a really great search result. And then a hint, bless you. Something that you want to make sure that you do, especially creditors, if you are filing a complaint against debtors, please check the main case to ensure that they haven't moved. Okay? What will happen is when you search the Social Security number, if there was a change of address in the main case, when you search in the adversary proceeding, it's going to identify the address that was originally identified with that debtor or joint debtor when the case was opened. That global record never changes. So you might need to update, you know, the record when you add the debtor into the case. You might need to update the address because it's going to pull the original address. So I would recommend go back to the main case. Even sometimes the debtor's attorneys don't always recognize that their client has moved from the time that the petition was filed. So take a look at the main case. If there's a new address, a change of address, make sure that that's identified in your complaint as well. And that you're adding the correct address. We do check that stuff, but we see it, unfortunately, that mistake made quite often. So you're going to add all of the plaintiffs to the case. CMECF has a function where it just essentially is a circuit. You know, you enter the first plaintiff, it gives you the opportunity to enter the second plaintiff. So it will keep going into that loop or through that loop until you indicate that you're done with the plaintiff selection, and then you do the same for the defendant selection.
Right. And if you're relying on staff to, you know, do this for you, I would just have a caution. And I haven't seen it lately, but for a while, we had one particular firm that was using, I guess this is kind of a state court thing where they say, you know, plaintiff versus the defendant, and then serve. And they write in their caption of their original complaint, they would say serve, and then they would have, like, what is it, TDS, you know, resolution systems, or what, you know, a resident registered agent right in there on their front page in the caption of their original complaint. Well, whoever was inputting, opening up the adversary, was picking that agent for service of process as one of the defendants. They didn't like being sued by all of, you know, these debtors. They're just the agent for service of process. They're not a defendant, and it was difficult to get that kind of, once you get somebody in as a defendant, now do you have to amend your complaint to take them out? I mean, there's all kinds of issues that are created. So if you've got a straight lien strip adversary where it's the debtor's the plaintiff versus that mortgage company, Wells Fargo, or whoever it is, don't put John Stumpf, CFO, on the first page and then make him like a defendant. He isn't. It's the corporate defendant, and that should take care of your problem. Now, service is another issue, but I'm just, you want to train, be careful when you're training your staff as to how to input these so you get the correct people in from the get-go.
When I recommend, you know, referring the staff to this document, and if they have any questions, just have them call the help desk, have them give me a call, and we can help them through the process. Because having that complaint or on the docket correctly with all of the parties correctly to begin with before the issuance of the summons is very helpful, obviously, to everyone. Adding an attorney. So if you're filing the petition or if you're filing the complaint, if you're the initiator, you will be associated with the plaintiffs automatically. If, let's say, you're the trustee and the debtors are the defendants, make sure that you're linking. If the debtors were represented in the main case, that attorney should be pulled over to this adversary proceeding. Okay? So you want to add that attorney to the case as representing the debtors. And then just go through the screenshots. I guess another tip, if you represent debtors, so you're the initiator of the action, you represent the plaintiffs, and the plaintiffs are the debtors, there's no filing fee for that. Please don't pay us. I point that out because the finance department always says, make sure that people don't pay us when they don't need to pay us, because we work for the federal government, and sometimes it takes a little bit to get that, you know, especially if you paid it and we've already receipted it, to that process to refund that money sometimes is more more problem than not paying it at all. And if you're not sure, just ask us and we'll let you know. And then after you receive, so if you haven't ever filed a complaint, what will happen is you will file your complaint. We will get it. Chambers will issue a summons. You will get the notice of electronic filing. From that notice of electronic filing, you print your summons, and that's how you serve your summons and complaint. And then upon service of the summons and complaint, the flip side of the summons is a certificate of service, or it's a document entitled certificate of service. And in here, yes, if you use certificate of service as the event, that's okay. But there is a specific event called summons service executed, and we like that event to actually be used because it allows you to put in the date served, and then that information pulls over to the final docket text. Remember that, of course, the filing of a summons and complaint, so just putting the complaint on the docket does not constitute proper service for the summons and complaint. So as Judge mentioned, I know Judge Kelly has a nice little cheat sheet out on her procedure page on best practices of serving, and I guess we've learned that over time of the stripping of the second mortgage liens. I think that's it. What questions do you have about adversary proceedings?
Somebody's talking on there. Tim. It says mute, but somebody's talking. Why don't you quickly hit the debtor bankruptcy noticing, and then we'll wrap up.
No, we're running out of time, so I'll talk really quickly. I have some pamphlets for you, so I'm counting on your free advertising distribution to some of your clients. There's a lot of information on the website about debtor electronic bankruptcy noticing. I've tried to boil down some of the quick hit items on the attached sheet, the quick reference guide. Really what it is a way for debtors to get through the BNC electronic copies of the court-generated notices. So this is different than an NEF. The NEF is generated immediately upon filing through CMECF, and that sends you your free look. This is different. Once the BNC gets the request to send a debtor, like an order or some kind of notice from the court, the BNC then changes that over to an email, a PDF copy, and emails the debtor. Only debtors that have email addresses on file. So it's different than an NEF. Also, this is only for court notices. So if you're noticing debtors in a case, you're not going to be able to take advantage of this system. It's really for the benefit of debtors to get emails instead of paper copies that could get lost in the mail.
Right, so you still, as a trustee or as a creditor, you still have to send snail mail notice to that debtor. Even if they have an attorney, it's a rule we watch very carefully. If a new creditor is filing a motion for relief from stay and it's an attorney that we haven't seen before, we look and make sure they not only serve the debtor's attorney and the trustee, but also, and they can do that through CMECF, that's great, but they have to snail mail to that debtor and give us a certificate of service to that effect. We watch that carefully, and we still see a lot of people who aren't familiar. They think, hey, they've got a lawyer. I'm just serving the lawyer. Doesn't work that way for debtors. You have to snail mail that debtor. So even though your debtor, your client may have said, hey, I don't want to get this mail. I have trouble with my mail. I want to get mail from the court electronically. I want them to email my discharge. I want them to email my 341 notice. Great, but anybody who's trying to send notice to that debtor other than the court still has to snail mail.
There's a lot of information on the website if you want to check it out. The application process is all electronic, so your debtors just have to go and each fill out an application that gets automatically submitted to my office. And if you do have any questions or if your clients have any questions, they can call me. My number is listed here. My email address is on the website. So if I can answer any questions offline, I'd be happy to do that.
And it's free. It's not like a CMECF where they can only get one free look. They will have this electronic notice. Their discharge, it'll be a PDF document. They have to be able to open up PDF documents.
And we do have links to Adobe Reader on our website, too, if they need to download that software. But they will
sure.
be able to print it, save it, send it to you, whatever they need
right,
to do.
Right, right. So it's a great feature for the right person. And I think, a couple of pro se's were our first customers, so good for them. And I think the big Chapter 11 cases, the debtors are going to want to get emails rather than the snail mail from the court. And I hope that some of your clients will take advantage of it, too. Okay, we're out of time. Thanks for coming. Come back next month for Ryan and Nathan on divorce in Chapter 13. See you next month. Thanks, guys.